In the coming week, another pivotal general election looms, this time in the Philippines. Hong Kong holds a vote for a new chief executive, and G7 foreign ministers convene in Germany. It's May 5th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, let's go right to that pivotal election. This is the Philippines. Monday, May 9th, the voters there will decide really across thousands of positions, but the one that's focusing attention, obviously, is the presidency. Who will take over from the controversial figure of Rodrigo Duterte? Leading in the polls by a pretty comfortable margin so far is Ferdinand Marcos Jr., son of the late Filipino dictator. Can you give us a bit more of a sense of what this general election is about, Jim?
Well, Bob, you're quite right. There's certainly not much suspense in Monday's elections in the Philippines. They look to be a foregone conclusion. As you note, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., who goes by the nickname Bongbong, is widely expected to win. He's running 30 to 40 points ahead of his nearest competitor in the race. I should also note that the race for vice president in the Philippines looks to be a runaway. Sara Duterte Caprio looks like she's going to take that race. She's also running at least 30 points ahead of the opposition. And if her name sounds familiar, it's because she is the daughter of outgoing President Rodrigo Duterte, who is barred by the Philippines Constitution from running for re-election. As you mentioned, Marcos Jr. is the son of the longtime Filipino dictator Marcos Sr. He won the presidency in 1965, imposed martial law in 1971, kept it in place until 1981, and was finally ousted in 1986 amidst a public uprising. It became quite clear that the elder Marcos had stolen a lot of money from the Philippines. I think the Guinness Book of World Records still has him listed as orchestrating the biggest theft of government funds. I'm not sure that's really a title. I'm sure there have been others who have surpassed it. And of course, Marcos's mother is Imelda Marcos, who for some people who remember that era became infamous for owning more than 3,000 pairs of shoes.
Became sort of a metaphor for abuse of power, shall we say.
It certainly did. And that's the big question is what kind of government will the younger Marcos run? I will note that he's held a number of government positions over the year. He's been a regional governor, served in the Philippines House. He's also been a senator. So he has significant government experience. So the conversation is now turning to what kind of administration will Marcos run? I think the expectation is it'll be more orderly than Duterte's was. Duterte, like most populist nationalists, authoritarian leading presidents mismanaged his government, as well as the response to COVID-19. But I think a lot of people are really wondering what Marcos is going to do on two critical issues. One is the future of Philippines democracy, and the second is the future of Philippines foreign policy. On the first front, I think a lot of people are worried that Marcos harbors the same authoritarian leanings as his father, and that the elder Duterte's presidency is actually paved the way to move Philippines further away from its democratic moorings. There's been a lot of talk about how Marcos Jr. has solidified his family's relations with a number of the other leading families in the Philippines, families that have dominated Filipino politics for decades. Marcos's campaign has also been helped by what looks to be rampant disinformation in its favor, a whitewashing of what his father did when he ran the country, a lot of creation of fake pro-Marcos accounts, a lot of misinformation spread about voting, about the origins of COVID and things like that. Marcos has also suggested that he's not going to shine a spotlight on some of the unseemly things that were done under the Duterte presidency, particularly the vigilante drug war. Marcos has said he's not going to cooperate with any international investigations of what had happened there. On the foreign policy front, Marcos Jr. has suggested he is going to try to woo Beijing to get more Chinese investment in the Philippines. Of course, the elder Duterte tried that tack when he came to office and did not get much from it. Marcos Jr. has actually suggested he might go further and relinquish the victory that the Philippines won in the International Tribunal arbitration on Chinese claims in the South China Sea. It's not obvious that Beijing is going to be more forthcoming with Marcos Jr. than it was with Duterte. And it's clear that China is very unpopular among the public in the Philippines. So it's not clear to what extent Marcos Jr. will feel any pushback from the broader public. All of this poses some big challenges or some potential challenges for the Biden administration. The administration has said it wants to prevent democratic backsliding, but it also wants to enlist countries to form a counterweight to Chinese power. So the administration is going to face the question of how it can square that circle when it comes to the Philippines.
Jim, our colleague Josh Kurlansky has written on our website that, as you indicate, we're looking at potentially the stakes for democracy in the Philippines and really important foreign policy issues, including the state of the U.S.-Philippines alliance, their ability to be partners. Josh has indicated there's almost antipathy by Marcos Jr. towards the U.S. And as you say, that this relationship with China could get extremely warm at a time when we're really looking at the ratcheting up of U.S.-China competition in the region. It's already been intense. Did we get a sense, though, you know, such a huge lead in the polls? Duterte had this stormy tenure, but yet his daughter seems to be leading. Do we get a sense the Philippine public is, at the end of the day, they're saying enough things about maybe domestic issues that's going to win the day here?
Well, one of the things you see in the Philippines, and it appears in many other countries, is that there is concerted opposition to an authoritarian populist. The problem is that that opposition is divided. There's no agreement as to who should be the candidate to oppose the front runner. And so that is clearly helping Marcos in all of this. There are plenty of domestic issues roiling the Philippines, most notable the mismanagement of the response to COVID-19. But the Philippines, like most other countries, has issues dealing with slow economic growth, economic inequality, high rates of poverty. It's not at all clear that Marcos Jr. has an actionable program for addressing those problems. And again, the campaign's approach has looked to be not articulating lots of detailed policy papers about how the government can respond, but through manipulating information, helping provide an echo chamber, a multiplier for disinformation. And there have been concerted social media attacks on Marcos's closest competitor, Leni Robredo, who is the incumbent vice president. She has focused her campaign on restoring democracy in the Philippines, fighting corruption, but for a variety of reasons, in part because of these sustained social media attacks, she has not really been able to get through and build a winning coalition.
And I've also been following the cases and the activities of Maria Ressa, the well-known Filipino journalist who's faced any number of government efforts to stifle both her publication, Rappler, and herself, and she herself. And I think she's kind of a bellwether for, you know, sort of how Philippine society is going to emerge from this and whether or not we're going to see a real authoritarian streak come through.
Well, again, we have seen that in the past with the Philippines when the elder Marcos operated as a dictator for more than a decade. So in some sense, it could be back to the future. Bob, let's turn our conversation to Hong Kong, where a committee is set to vote in a chief executive election this Sunday, May 8th. In this upcoming vote, there is only one candidate. I guess that simplifies things. That candidate is John Lee. He most recently served as Hong Kong's chief secretary for administration. He is backed by China's central government. So tell us more, Bob, about Mr. Lee and the major issues factoring into his selection. It doesn't seem to really be an election.
Yeah, very good point, Jim. I mean, this is an election that is very much stage managed by Beijing, although in the greater scheme of things, it's still some sort of independent voicing of views going on that maybe we wouldn't see in the mainland. But let's talk a little bit about John Lee. As you said, former chief secretary, so the second highest ranked government official in Hong Kong, the sole person chosen to run. So previous elections for this position, even though they've included figures favored by Beijing, there have been competitions. There's no competition at all. John Lee was a strong supporter of the, you may recall, the China extradition bill. That was actually lifted, but it had sparked protests in 2019 that then caused huge reprisals. But because of his support, John Lee's support for that bill, he was sanctioned by the U.S. in 2020, and also for his role in curtailing political freedoms in Hong Kong. And, you know, his position is an incredibly tough one. In some ways, in the best case scenario, seen as a technocrat who tried to restore the sort of stature of Hong Kong as a financial hub. And it's part of his manifesto that he's laid out. He's saying, I'm going going to, you know, get the economy back going again. It's notable he does not have the economic background that previous chief executives have had. And so that's raised some concern in the fact that he's had this security profile has raised a lot of concern that he's going to be doing Beijing's bidding on further cracking down on security. The other big issue looming here is how to emerge from COVID-19. So for Hong Kong to be in any sort of a functioning hub, they're going to have to come up with a coherent policy for opening up, first of all, connections to the mainland. There's disrupted connections and travel between Hong Kong and the mainland right now. Zero COVID policy continues to be something that is focusing tensions on the mainland. And so it's going to involve intense, what are expected to be intense negotiations between the mainland and Hong Kong about those ties, and then opening up to the rest of the world as well. It's partly because of the security crackdown from the 2019 demonstrations, as well as the COVID policies in Hong Kong that have caused this further steady flight of business leaders and others from Hong Kong abroad. And so something like 90,000 or so in the past year have left. It's still, the population is about 7.5 million, but there's a real concern about this particular choice of John Lee, the uncontested choice of a security stalwart, as being a further sort of death knell for what has been left of any sort of independence, let alone democratic streak in Hong Kong. And so we're going to have to see sort of how the city-state emerges from this whole experience, Jim, but it's looking pretty grim. As I say, best case scenario is there's some sort of coherent policy for Hong Kong opening up.
Bob, in looking at what's happening in Hong Kong, does it tell us anything more broadly about the future of China? I ask because China over the last several decades has had tremendous economic growth, stunning economic growth that has catapulted into a position of being a superpower. But in recent years under President Xi, it looks as if the Chinese government is actually throttling many of the drivers of that great growth. We have seen tech leaders like Jack Ma basically sidelined. Now you have here the Chinese basically crushing the vibrancy of Hong Kong, which is a major international financial center. You say people are moving away from Hong Kong because they want to be in a place where they have continued freedoms. Is Xi undoing the secret sauce that really propelled China?
It's a crucial question, Jim. And, you know, a number of China analysts that I've been reading on recently have basically said this is what we're seeing at the moment is Xi doubling down on his approach to asserting central authority, asserting his authority, not just in Hong Kong, but in China as a whole, in terms of squashing voices that could be voices of dissent or variance with the central policy, whether it's on COVID, whether it's business leaders, as you mentioned, and whether it's a feisty former British outpost that is supposed to be, you know, coming into the fold. And by the way, that, you know, this just this coming June and July will be the 25th anniversary of the reversion of Hong Kong to China under what was touted as the one country, two systems. The two systems is pretty much gone by the boards. And it's fitting a pattern that has shown that he sees the future of China as one in which there's a centrally dominated approach to reining in dissident voices, to reining in wayward, maybe even corrupt voices to getting the country going, and a confidence that the economy will power through, that they'll, because of the stability involved from a properly centrally managed process, they can manage it. But the question there, as you are getting at, Jim, is are they sort of reining in the so-called animal spirits of the economy that had been so crucial to China's amazing emergence over the last several decades, the blueprint that Deng Xiaoping had kind of unopened and laid out. It's really a question of getting Hong Kong reined in and fully folded into China. Does that just squash the entrepreneurial spirit of Hong Kong, but also send a further message to China and to those who would do business with China that there's a new order of business? This is supposed to be the year, by the way, later on, in which Xi is coronated formally as this incredibly powerful ruler. He's going to be, by all accounts, renewed in his leadership for an unprecedented third term. And so, you know, we'll have to see, Jim. But Hong Kong, I think, is very much a bellwether for the rest of China in this regard. Security is paramount, quashing dissident voices. Hong Kong used to have a really vibrant media situation that's all been all but squashed. You've had business leaders who notably have tended in the past to turn away from politics and focus on the business of doing business, have found that what's happening in Hong Kong really distasteful. And there's a lot of concern that what had been this really magical place in some regards and a very special place has turned for the foreseeable future in another direction under the sway of Beijing.
On the question of the reaction by Beijing to COVID, do you think, Bob, that Beijing can keep up this zero tolerance policy? I note that that there were news stories coming out that in some Chinese cities, Chinese authorities have gone so far as to padlock people in their homes and then put wire meshing around so they can't get out. Is this a sustainable policy?
It's hard to see this. Certainly standing here in the United States and seeing what we've just gone through in the past 2 years, which has been messy, to say the least, in terms of the response and the public policy response.
We crossed 1 million deaths this week.
1 million deaths. It's hard to fathom another country being able to pursue these types of policies. And Chinese officials are quick to point out, you know, don't start casting aspersions on us. Look at the way you've responded to COVID. Be that as it may, you know, human nature being what it is, that the what we've seen in Shanghai has been sort of extraordinary. People locked in giant apartment complexes for a month to more than a month. April 1st, I think, is when it started in some of these massive blocks, not being able to leave their apartment, let alone the going on the grounds of the apartment block because one or two cases were reported. You know, drones coming by and sort of pointing out to residents that, you know, they should not be making noises out loud or doing other things that can somehow spread the virus. You know, lining up deliveries of food so people get their food, even though there's been widespread reports of shortages and a real concern about shortages of all sorts of things. It's hard to imagine that continuing, especially if Beijing now, which is the new focal point of the COVID policy, whether they're really going to be able to follow that through in a city where, you know, you have, first of all, a great deal of inequality, but also a number of people used to certain sort of privileges and forcing them to be locked down could create some sort of a backlash. So while I say it's hard to fathom, it's also, I guess it offers a real dichotomy between a country like China and the U.S. approach that we've seen under COVID, Jim.
And I will note that the coronavirus hasn't stopped evolving and mutating. News coming out of South Africa that new variants have been discovered that may be even more infectious than the existing strains that we're dealing with, and that they may evade some of our successful vaccines like the ones manufactured by Moderna and Pfizer.
Yeah, this gets to the other issue, which is, you know, the ability to continue to try to roll out vaccines worldwide, let alone in the United States, and the ability to which, let's say, China will adopt the messenger RNA vaccines, which have been far more effective than the Chinese vaccines, for example. But also in the U.S., will there be a policy on boosting? You know, people have now gone through one and two rounds of vaccines in most cases, although there's still a solid minority that refuses vaccines. But will there be, you know, a new push, especially if lingering or new variants come forth that are continuing to throttle parts of the country or pose a health threat, certainly to the more vulnerable people? What seems to be emerging, Jim, is that the later versions of COVID that we're seeing, the variants, the Omicron follow-ons, as you will, are not as sort of threatening to general health in terms of hospitalization and fatalities as previous versions were. But still, for those who are vulnerable, for those who have immune deficiencies and so forth, they are very serious, and that has an impact. So, you know, as a broader case here, I think Hong Kong had a hard time dealing with COVID, both as a sort of declining democracy and as a emerging autocracy. China is struggling with its zero COVID policy. COVID is defying sort of any sort of governance system. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not there can be any sort of, you know, central playbook for the world to combat it.
Well, it certainly seems that Mother Nature is not done with us. But I would note that there's a big difference between China and the United States. We have had rampant infections, and I think we've come to a point where we're willing to tolerate as a society some level of infection. China, however, looks like it is just doubling down on its zero tolerance policy. So it is going to be playing essentially whack-a-mole for quite a long time and have to deal with all the disruptions that that entails.
That's right, Jim. And you know, circling back to Hong Kong for a second, you know, Hong Kong, which is a place where you still have people from many international backgrounds coming to do business, and you have kind of, you know, masters of the universe, bankers and other types from around the world, including the U.S. and other democracies. They're sort of chafing under this kind of whack-a-mole approach and the unending nature seemingly of it. So it has real consequences for a place like Hong Kong.
Certainly does.
Jim, I want to take our discussion now to Europe, though, where the group of seven foreign ministers are set to meet in the coming week in Germany. Under the German G7 presidency, the foreign affairs minister, Annalena Baerbock of the Green Party, will host the foreign ministers from May 12th through 14th. Could you tell us what's on the agenda for this meeting?
Bob, the meeting has four big topics: Ukraine, climate, COVID, and democratic resilience. It's a good bet that Ukraine is going to dominate the conversation. I would imagine three topics in particular particular are going to preoccupy the foreign ministers. One is how to ratchet up pressure on Russia. Second one is how to better coordinate the delivery of weapons to Ukraine. And the third is perhaps the biggest and most important, what exactly are the war aims in Ukraine? On the first point, was a major potential move this week when the European Union released a plan to phase out imports of Russian oil by the end of the year. This was really big news because, again, go back 3 months in the Convention of Wisdom, there was no way that the Europeans could wean themselves off of Russian oil anytime soon. Now we have the EU talking about ending imports of Russian oil by the end of the year. Pretty big change. Now, the plan hasn't been enacted, and there are some objectors within the EU, I think particularly Hungary and Slovakia, have raised some concerns about it. But if this plan does go into effect, it would certainly be a significant step for the European Union and for the effort to put pressure on Russia. I will note that the European Union got about a third of its oil from Russia in 2021. So again, this is pretty significant. On the issue of coordination, Minister Baerbock has made this a priority. It's one thing to say we're going to deliver weapons to Ukraine. It's another matter of going through the messy issue of logistics to make sure they get there in a coherent, coordinated way. And I think they want to look for ways to make that run more efficiently. And finally, we get to the question of what are we trying to accomplish in supporting Ukraine? Again, the Ukrainians have done much better in fighting than I think anybody anticipated. If you go back just a couple of weeks, there are great fears that the refocused Russian military operations in the east would lead to a big breakthrough. It appears so far that the Ukrainian military has held up, blunted that offensive. But there's still the bigger question of what is the end goal here? Obviously, if you're Ukraine, you want to recover your sovereign territory. But does that mean recovering all of the territory that existed as of February 24th? Is it broader to include Ukraine as it stood back in 2014 before the Russians seized Crimea and fomented a separatist rebellion in eastern Ukraine? And again, while Western and Ukrainian interests may be aligned, they're not identical. And one of the big challenges for the Biden administration is to figure out ways to sustain current levels of Western cooperation. And again, it's not too difficult to look at the leading countries in that coalition and to see differences on how far the West should be willing to go. And, you know, there are a couple of possible outcomes here. One is a big Russian breakthrough. Another is in the other end of the spectrum, a big Ukrainian breakthrough where they begin to really roll back Russian forces, or a continued stalemate. And again, to what extent can the West support a negotiated outcome? To what extent should the West try to force a negotiated outcome? And how best do you do that? Those are some really tough diplomatic questions that the foreign ministers are going to have to grapple with when they meet in this coming week.
Jim, I'm struck by the kind of open-ended nature of this conflict that you lay out, even despite the huge consequences that is continuing to have, not only for the region, but for the whole world. And I would also note for our listeners that our sister podcast, The President's Inbox, you had an interesting discussion with State Department Counselor Derek Chollet on this. One of the things that struck me was the, you know, that he was saying that there continues to be no sign at all that Vladimir Putin is willing to seriously negotiate an end to this. And even as we've seen, you know, halting attempts to open up humanitarian corridors into a place like Mariupol, even that can barely work. I think we saw 100 people escape through International Committee of the Red Cross corridor a few days ago. But given the scale and the number of people who still supposedly hold up there, that is another dark chapter in this war. So it just leaves open the question then, do we continue to sort of try to create some sort of a noose on this massive country in which, you know, which still has options in other parts of the world to do business and continue to carry on this campaign for who knows how long?
Well, you're certainly right, Bob, that the conflict doesn't look to be ripe for a negotiated settlement, but that doesn't settle the matter. The question is, to what extent should you be acting proactively to try to create the conditions for ripeness? And again, part of that you can argue is by arming the Ukrainians to put the pressure on the Russians to force them to recalculate what their interests are. A flip side potentially is trying to outline to the Russians what you're willing to do in a positive sense if they step back. I haven't seen much from the West on that score, and there are arguments pro and cons for putting a package on the table or signaling what you're willing to do. And again, clearly from the Kremlin, one concern they could have is, even if they were to back down, that the crippling sanctions that have been put in place will remain in place. And again, this gets you into the sort of the thorny issues of negotiations, of coercion. Do you want to give your adversary an out? Do you want to accept less than complete victory? And, you know, one of the arguments for leaving off ramps, as they like to say in diplomatic lingo, is that if you don't give the adversary an out, then they have nothing left to lose. And that's dangerous. And it's particularly dangerous when you're dealing with a nuclear armed superpower. And that's why I think there are a number of people who are very worried about what might happen in the coming week. May 9 is a very big day on the Russian calendar. It marks Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. There's talk that perhaps Vladimir Putin may declare war. There's some talk that perhaps Belarus may join in the fighting in Ukraine. And if Russia were to declare war, that this would, under Russian law, open up possibilities for mass mobilization of troops and the like. And again, part of the challenge here is making sure that the actions that you take don't produce an even worse outcome than the one you might be facing. And one of the great historical examples in this case would be the U.S. and the United Nations approach in Korea back in 1950, where originally the goal was to basically recover South Korea. And then there was the fateful decision to go north of the 38th parallel toward the Yalu River to destroy North Korea. And that triggered Chinese intervention in the war. So again, I think these are sort of the issues that diplomats are going to have to grapple with, trying to balance between doing too little and doing too much.
So we'll be keeping an eye on the issue of mission creep in Germany next week, among other things.
Very much so, Bob. Bob, we reached the point in our podcast where we talk about our audience figures of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected India-Pakistan heatwave. Tell me more.
Jim, if your news feed includes, like mine, maps of any sort, you might have been struck by the map emerging from South Asia, especially of India and Pakistan. A true heat map. It was pulsing with dark orange and red colors throughout, and that's signifying the heat wave hitting the region. In the words of a Pakistan Minister of Climate Change, Sherry Raymond, it's a springless year that the region is facing. And that's because of temperatures, let's just note New Delhi, 7 straight days of 40 degrees Celsius or over that. And that's, if you're doing the mental calculation, that's 104 Fahrenheit. And that's above normal, shall we say, although this part of the world does get, you know, hotter springs than we've seen in other parts of the world. But also Pakistan is getting these temperatures. And these are temperatures that are hitting large numbers of people who don't have the ability to find easy relief, you know, central air conditioning and ready access to water and so forth. It's focusing yet again attention on what's to be done in the face of obvious climate changes to bolster resilience. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, as we've noted previously in this podcast, has mentioned that if current trends continue, there's going to be no way the world meets the goal set in the Paris Climate Agreement to limit heating to pre-industrial levels of 1.5 degrees Celsius. In fact, it's more on track to be 3 degrees more than that by in the next, I believe, decade or so. So this then raises the question, okay, how do we respond to things like intense heat occasions or all the other things that we're starting to see as well, intense storms, rising sea levels and so forth. And so this gets back to the resiliency issue, Jim, and you know, what can the world do to kind of forestall the inevitable, seemingly inevitable, although it's happening in sometimes unexpected ways.
So what are the options, Bob?
Jim, if you talk to climate experts, especially those who responded to the IPCC report just from March or the IPCC report itself, they mention a whole host of things that need to be done. And by the way, need to be done collectively, not just one or two, but all of these approaches. And these include everything from carbon sequestration. So sucking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it underground. That's one thing that's been given a great deal of attention recently, to trying to speed up the, you know, conversion to renewables, to non-carbon creating renewable energies, wind and solar in particular. That is happening, but it's not happening fast enough. How do you incentivize that to happen across countries that are still relying on coal, for example? You know, we just talked about Ukraine, that's focused eyes again on fossil fuel needs needs, which are not going away anytime soon. So again, back to the resiliency question, what do you do? You do have to create a global approach to providing relief from heat. And that gets into everything from, you know, reforestation to urban centers having more shade, more trees, more air conditioning opportunities, all those types of things. It's not going to come from a lot of poor local governments. It's going to have to be a collective international effort. I think we're going to see a lot more on this front. We did see that at the Glasgow meetings. We saw a lot of discussion on that. Our colleague Alice Hill talked about that a lot on the website at the time. You're going to start seeing more and more as it becomes clear the world is not going to be able to move this unwieldy bus in the direction that's needed to reduce carbon emissions. So then what is it going to do to withstand all of these things? The other thing I would add, Jim, is in relation to rising sea levels, especially for those coastal communities, there's all sorts of plans and approaches that are being floated, pardon the expression, for cities to deal with it, from seawalls to reimagining cities as sort of floating habitats as well. So as you can see, a lot of different things, a lot of different kind of tectonic shifts that needs to happen, and it's got to happen quicker than it is.
Bob, I would like to be optimistic about adaptation. And I know our colleague Alice Hill in her books, particularly the latest one, The Fight for Climate Change After COVID-19, has talked about all the multiple ways we can work to adapt. But the price tag is extraordinarily high. And even then, it's not clear that we're going to be able to adapt. By some forecasts, places like the Persian Gulf, I think South Asia, may at certain points of the year be so hot and humid as to be very difficult to sustain human life. It's not clear we're going to really be able to deal with that. And that, of course, leads to migration. And that's the great story of humanity, going back beginning of time, people moving away when conditions force them to go on the march. That, of course, conflicts with our whole sense of nation states and borders and countries, which gets us into the issue of whether or not we can find a technological fix or a technological band-aid to help us stave off the most catastrophic outcomes. Our colleague, Stuart Patrick, released a report this week, which looks at the issue of potential solar deflection, which is the idea that you could somehow seed the atmosphere with particles designed to make solar radiation reflect out, to basically buy yourself time to do the things like actually cutting emissions and perhaps creating time for developing these sequestration technologies you talk about. But again, that's shrouded in a lot of controversy because it's not clear how well it would work, and it's not clear what the consequences of what critics call geoengineering are going to be or who would bear those costs. But I think those are the tough conversations that we're going to have going forward, because it is clear, it is unmistakably clear that we are heating up the globe and it has very real consequences.
And that's our look at the heating up world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. U.S. President Biden meets Italian Prime Minister Draghi at the White House. Rodrigo Chavez takes office as Costa Rica's new president. And the United States hosts a virtual global summit on COVID-19.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you as always, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be careful out there.